Hello and welcome to Compass Live, the best and the only podcast dedicated to proof of work mining. Today on the show, we have two awesome guests that I have personally been wanting on this stream for quite a while. There's a huge world out there relating to mining protocols that, frankly, we haven't touched much on this podcast and live stream yet to date. And we really need to tackle it because they're really important things. On top of mining networks, you have tons of different protocol designs that you can build. And today we have two guests to kind of talk about that. So we have Ivan Bogatti, researcher at Dragonfly Capital and founder co-founder of Mining DAO, a protocol that decentralizes Ethereum block production. We also have Uri Klarman, CEO of Bloxroot Labs and founder of Eagle Project and an Ethereum researcher. So thank you both so much for joining this conversation today. I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Will. By the way, I gotta say, I love the intro. I keep watching it, and it just like always puts you in the right mood.
Right? Kind of, yeah, good. Kind of groovy.
I'll give it to Zach. He's always doing a good job with that kind of stuff, kind of setting us up here for a great conversation. So before we jump into it, I do want to kind of preface this whole conversation because it is quite different than our other topics. Like sometimes we have public mining protocols on talking about, or public mining firms talking about capital allocation and how they're deploying hash rate. Sometimes we have some Bitcoin developers talking about Bitcoin mining specifically on the protocol level. And here and there we get some Ethereum miners. Today, I think we really got some cream of the crop conversation going on how Ethereum mining matters and why Ethereum mining is kind of pushing the edge on the protocol side of things. And we're going to dive into that with both Ivan and Uri here today with relay networks. Relay networks are kind of the battleground space between nodes and miners talking to each other. And it's a very deep topic. We've seen a lot of different protocols over the year, from Bitcoin's fiber network to newer protocols like Flashbots. And there's a lot of nuance in this conversation. And mainly just for the audience, I'd love just to see if Ivan and Uri can just kind of take this whole thing over and have their minds kind of spinning between the two of them. So Ivan, I want to start off with you. If you could give us a little background and then Uri will kick it over to you for the same point. Ivan, where are you at now? What kind of work are you doing at Dragonfly?
Yeah, so I'm a research partner at Dragonfly, which means I generally do like protocol research, sort of mostly like whatever stuff interests me, kind of publish on that. Some of the recent fun stuff I've done mostly been around like MEV and Ethereum research, some scalability research and so on. And then I'm also building Mining DAO, which is this infrastructure company. It's kind of a way to change the Ethereum protocol to add another intermediary layer in there, so that like right now mining pools essentially bundle two things. One is they like distribute rewards and handle the mining side of things, but they also handle the consensus side of things, where they package transactions, they try to like find all the pending transactions, or actually kind of the highest value pending transactions, and package them into blocks for the miners to mine. And so I think these two, it was kind of clear maybe like a year ago or like a year and a half that these two are ripe to be unbundled. And there's several projects working on this. I think Flashbots was the first, and they kind of caused a bunch of controversy because at the time, the social consensus was that it's taboo and you're like not allowed to do this stuff. And kind of like explicitly dealing with MEV, like explicitly screwing with Ethereum consensus was like very taboo before they started. And then I think kind of there's been like a few other approaches there. I'm sure Uri would add more to that.
Yeah, Uri, same question to you. Ivan, I do want to appreciate the head nod out to Edgar for the consensus questions back in April and May. Uri, throw out a question to you. What are you working on at Bloxroot and some other projects that you're working on?
So I'll focus on Bloxroot. We're called Bloxroot because we route blocks. Okay, so we're going to talk about relay network. Basically, we propagate transactions and blocks close to the speed of light. Just to set the ground for the conversation, a relay network is any network where if I'm trying to send a message to Ivan, then rather than send it directly to him, I give it to somebody to send it to him, right? So if you're using a VPN or something, that's a relay network, right? You give it to, I give it to the closest server who brings it to another server who sends it to where I want, and we hide, you know, they don't know where it it's coming from. And it could be whether that's Flashbots. And what we do, basically, we allow people to send their transaction extremely fast to mining pools, especially in Ethereum, but also BSC on Polygon, layer one, layer twos. Basically, we send transaction fast. We allow people to hear about transaction and blocks fast. And in this world of DeFi, where if you hear about an opportunity faster and you can act on it faster, that means a lot of money. Then that's kind of like the core of our business. Basically, see opportunities faster, send it faster. So what we do is basically propagate close to the speed of light. We're not at the speed of light yet, but we're not that far off from it. And that's kind of like our bread and butter.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's a place to start for any conversation on relay networks, which of course is a pretty deep topic. Like you have to kind of be around the block a few times to know even what they are. And we're going to get into some like nuanced engineering details, or hopefully we will later in the stream. I kind of want to kick the question back to you and do an explain it like I'm five. What is a relay network and why does it matter? And if there's any like historical precedent for some projects earlier in Ethereum's history, that might also help our audience.
Sure. So a relay network is just like some servers or some network which allows like to broadcast faster, or basically adds as an intermediary. I think the first one who like Matt Corello started with a fast Bitcoin relay network, which was later replaced by fiber. Basically, the idea is, again, to improve propagation. And at the time when Matt kind of like launched the project, blocks actually, we're going to talk about the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum, but basically block took quite a lot of time to propagate, like long seconds. And that was when blocks were like 20 kilobytes, 40 kilobytes, something like that. And who cares? Let's stop here. Like, who cares how long it takes for blocks to propagate? In the case of Bitcoin, if I'm a miner or I'm a pool and I mined a new block and I propagate it to the network, this time, this propagation time is a critical time, because during this time, somebody else, let's say I mined a new block, I send it to Ivan, Ivan send it to you, like it's being propagated in the network. This is the window of opportunities in which forks happen, right? Somebody on the other side of the world might mine a new block, which is competing with mine. It's not on top of mine because he hadn't heard about it yet, right? If he would have received it, he would mine on top of it, but he didn't. So this is about creating forks, and kind of like afterwards one would be orphaned and the chain would continue, but it destabilizes the consensus. It makes it less profitable, all these kind of things. So it started with that, but it's not so like, okay, so Bitcoin.
And by the way, if like Uri lets me sort of chime in for a second, I think he's kind of like underselling the value here, where right. Like the relay networks are like not even so much about just like an intermediary. It's more, I think, like to understand like how valuable Blockstart is, I think the starting point is to like understand sort of what's the status quo. And like the status quo is that like, it's not like, you know, you could send a block directly from like Uri to Ivan, right? That's actually not a possibility. If it was a possibility, that would be pretty nice. But the way sort of Ethereum and Bitcoin and everything else and like all the other proof of work chains work is you just like send the block to someone and they send it to someone else. And you hope that like eventually it like lands at the right place. And so like the right place is the other mining pools. So if you're like, you mine a block, the most crucial part for you is that like other pools get it and then they start mining on top of it as soon as possible. Whereas like Uri said, if they don't, they're going to mine in parallel and like you're going to have a conflict. And it's like, maybe like they lose, maybe you lose, but at least one of the participants loses in high uncle rates. And so kind of like the relay networks are like, instead of doing this kind of like dandelion type stuff, or not, I mean, dandelion is like a different term, but sort of instead of doing kind of this like wave style propagation, it's more like one hop propagation where you like send it to to a relay network, and then the block is sent directly to like all the other relay network participants.
Right. So, yeah. So we're like, let me hop in, but Will, totally. We're not going to let you talk anything. But basically, Ivan is right. Instead of like, okay, I give it to them and they give it to the rest of the people, and then it takes a while to. The idea of a relay network is give it to us. We broadcast it to everybody. So we significantly reduce the time. I think the point I was underselling is like how important that is for Bitcoin. And the answer is kind of important, but especially back in the day when propagation wasn't good and we weren't using like compact blocks and other techniques, etc. Where it does matter a lot is in Ethereum, okay? Because in Bitcoin, blocks come every 10 minutes, right? So every 600 seconds. So if it takes a second to propagate to everybody, then it's just one out of 600. Like the proportion of the time in which propagation happened is very, very small. But in Ethereum, blocks come every 13 seconds on average, right? So 1 second is actually quite a big portion of the time. And we have been seeing that what happens is that during this propagation time, A, forks happen, and we're going to talk about our contribution and how we affected like uncle rate and whatnot in a second. But not only do they happen, what happened is that the largest pools win all the time, right? It's kind of like, I mined a pool, and there's no longer a Spark pool nowadays, like, but Spark pool were mined a new block, and they would win 75% of the forks because they would obviously mine the next block on top of themselves, right? So they have like this unfair advantage. So basically, even before like diving into what we do at Bloxroute, the idea of the relay networks is to propagate blocks and transaction, kind of like make it all fast, which is almost like a common good. Like it's good for everybody. It's good for the mining pools. It's good for the users. Transaction reach them fast. So if you want your transaction to be mined in the next block, if it takes like 3 seconds just to reach all the mining pools and whatnot, then there's a good chance you're not going to be in the next block because it's being mined before you got them, right? It's kind of like you saw the example, which I like to give is if you're trading in DeFi or something like that, and like, oh, you know, you identify the bottom. You're awesome at trading. This is like the bottom. You click like, okay, I'm going to trade on Uniswap or something. But maybe by the time you heard about the bottom, maybe it's 2 seconds after the bottom actually happened. Maybe during this time, a new block was already mined. You just missed the opportunity. The next block was already mined before you even heard about it. Or maybe you did hear about it, but you click send, right? Or kind of like made the transaction. But by the time your transaction actually reached the mining pools and whatnot, well, the block was already mined. Ship and sailed. You like you lost opportunity. Price already boosting up. You missed it. So basically, this is about being fast. About hearing transaction, about hearing blocks, about sending transactions. That's kind of like, from my perspective, the important part of relay networks.
Yeah, I think you definitely did undersell it. And I think you undersell what you're doing at Bloxroute because you guys, it's like at the cutting edge of stuff that matters in Ethereum. If you think of block space as a commodity, well, the ability to get to that block space and be included in the next block has a price premium. And I think that is just the basis of this conversation and why relay networks can matter. That's not to say that there's other points around it. And that's something I want to bring up next, Ivan, kind of going through the history of different mining mechanisms, maybe like mining auction mechanisms. We brought up Matt Carello's fiber network earlier. Matt Carello is a former Bitcoin core developer. And the purpose for that network was to propagate blocks and make sure that the Bitcoin network could not be separated into two different forks because different blocks were working with different UTXO sets. Could you kind of walk us through what the purpose is for relay networks and what kind of different renditions we've seen from Bitcoin to Ethereum to today?
Sure. So Bitcoin side, I'm not as familiar, and I think you've like already covered. And so I'll primarily focus on Ethereum. And I think kind of the design space is much larger there. And so there's been several very interesting attempts to solve kind of disparate problems. And we've already covered relay networks and Bloxroute. And there's like a few other sort of risks that you want to mitigate. And so one of them is pool centralization. So there's a real problem where miners can't really mine alone. I think in Bitcoin, that's more because of the variance. So like the block reward is so huge that, you know, if you're like a at-home miner, you might have to wait for a couple of years. Or there's even this statistic that like most individual ASICs, like for the vast majority of them, like they would not ever in their lifetime mine a single block, which is kind of obvious if you like compare the price of an ASIC like to the price of like the single Bitcoin block. And so on the Ethereum side, that's not as big of a problem because the blocks are much more frequent, but it's a lot harder to like create the best possible blocks. And so MEV, like the access to that is somewhat
hard. You need to unpack MEV before you throw it in there.
Let's actually pull back from that then. And so just generally to avoid pool centralization, and there's like a few problems, the problems that are obvious in that kind of you don't want like a single pool to dictate Ethereum consensus. You don't want a single pool to have more than 50% and then like be able to do reorgs at will. But there are certain trends that...
Can I chime in for one thing just specifically about what you said? What Ivan is saying is right? In addition to the variance in payment, which is super important and it's a big thing, in addition to that, pools are actually running DevOps, right? Pools are actually running. They need to keep the node up to date. It's connected to everybody else, hear about transaction, produce all of that, et cetera. If you're small and you run it by yourself, you probably, if you want to be competitive, you need to pay a DevOps person to actually do that. So DevOps is like, I don't know, $100,000 per year for somebody to run just that. So if you're just like a one-man operation, you're either going to do a bad job about it or it's going to cost you tons of money. Really, pools really kind of like, well, they provide more than anything. They provide DevOps, right? Get connected to us. We'll get you, okay, what do you need to work on as soon as possible? We'll hear about block. We'll hear printed. We'll invest in really heavy machines, like really beefy machines in order to produce blocks super fast, to cut times, etc. And so this is the thing which... you know, economies of scale kind of like plays into like pools would do a better job and you will cost them less compared to 100 different small miners who do the same. So I just want to chime in on
exactly that. Exactly. And so if I was to like summarize this, as we've discussed earlier, pools bundle together kind of two services. One is a shares accounting for the miners, or like pooling of rewards, sort of like de-risking. And then two, like Uri said, DevOps. So that's all about, you know, like picking the best blocks, picking the best transactions, packaging them together, propagating, and so on. And so, on the DevOps side, I think maybe Bloxroute is a good example of like unbundling that service, where now it's available to anyone. You can actually now be like a solo miner connected to Bloxroute and have like comparable quality to Sparkpool. And then on the shares accounting side, again, there's kind of a trend for centralization because there's like more stable rewards and so forth. And like an interesting early attempt to fix this problem was a smart pool. And so the way smart pool attempted to solve this was essentially do all the shares accounting through a smart contract. And I don't know like how many details we want to get into. Like the counting of shares within pools is actually its own big problem. And I think kind of like for people not familiar with the nuances, it might seem simple. It's just like, oh, people are generating hashes. And then it's like whomever generates, it's like, okay, if I generated 10 hashes and Uri generated 20, then the rewards should be split like 2-to-1. You know, what else is there to think about? But then as you go into the nuance, there's actually a lot of complexity to that. And, you know, there's like pool hopping. There's various ways that like pools can damage one another. We might dive into that later, but for now, I wanted to say that. So kind of
there are stale, I think more than anything, there are stale shares, right? It's kind of like you created the share, but the pool tells you, well, by the time you gave it to me, like we already moved to the next block. So this is, you're not like, you shouldn't be rewarded. You're like, no, but you didn't tell me at this point, right? It's all about
exactly,
like,
exactly.
So yeah. Like there are complexities about that. And there's always tension around that.
Yeah. And so like one of the attempts to solve it and build like a decentralized solution where there's no kind of pool server in charge of everything was smart pool. And so they it's actually fascinating how technically sophisticated it was and how they built it like very early on, back when, you know, the sort of the crypto sophistication was like not nearly as high as it is now. And so it was a smart contract that used a bunch of clever tricks to simplify hashing. So it's like, it would like verify shares trustlessly. There was like a probabilistic algorithm for that. And you'd be able to like essentially get your reward from a smart contract, not from a pool. And so again, that was on the accounting side. And I think if it was launched now, it might very well work. The only difference would have been you'd need to like launch it in a layer two. So I think now there's like both technical sophistication on Ethereum and there's much better scalability in rollups, and like smart pool like wouldn't need interoperability. It only would need like, you know, a single channel to sort of track all the updates. So I think now it could work. At the time, I think the costs just did not justify the benefits, because it's like you submit shares, it's like an on-chain transaction, you have to pay a lot of money, and then you like get the reward, you pay a lot of money for that too. And so kind of like the verification was quite costly, obviously, because you do it on Ethereum in a smart contract instead of on your own server.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, just to kind of clarify and summarize what you both have said so far, mining is much more complicated than just the hashes from a machine that you might see on a pool operator just kind of watching your machine. And how you organize those hashes can be used to influence what the protocol looks like, including the inclusion of transactions into certain blocks. And if you try to create protocols around that to kind of help out with block propagation and transaction inclusion, you can come up with some really clever designs, but you can also risk centralizing the protocol itself, which is a pretty nuanced conversation that I think we should maybe get into.
I would actually say something. I disagree with the last.
Yeah, totally.
I think the risk of centralization exists regardless. I think whether that's like mining DAO, whether that's Flashbot, whether that's us at Bloxroute, the idea is actually, can we use Relay to solve that? But you know, we all you read the Bitcoin like white paper for the first time, and you're kind of your mind blown. It's kind of like, oh, this is super awesome, and kind of like that. And then you're kind of like, okay, you get that. And over time, you kind of like understand, well, here's like where proof of work is really awesome. Here's where what proof of stakes gives you, and etc. But over time, well, okay, you see that miners would prefer to kind of like work together because it reduces variance. That like introduces new entities, pools, which were never envisioned in the original ones, which affect security and how it's, and like, I'm not even talking about selfish mining, which isn't really that big of a problem, but it potentially could have been a problem. And so alluding to kind of like maybe like Ivan's mining DAO for a second, the idea is that not that these relays are introducing risk, rather that we're introducing relay networks offering maybe alternatives or solutions to some of the things that we've been seeing. And so if in the past, Ivan mentioned it, right, prior to Flashbots, it was taboo for kind of like miners and pools to order the transactions. Not to say they didn't do it completely, but it was definitely taboo. Everybody knew that when pools are like ordering transactions, it's like the referee shooting score, like scoring goals in a soccer game. Like it's like, that's not really fair, right? So like everybody knew that, but they were doing it anyway. And there was enough value there for them to extract heading toward the MEV like point that it happened, and it happened more and more and more and more. And then people, whether that's Flashbot or Ivan with mining that, they're like, what if we offer alternative to that? So instead of like mining pools having all the power and kind of extracting all of that in a way which maybe gives advantage for people in the know, right? If you're a friend of the pool, maybe you can do stuff that other people can get to do. I remember, because this podcast is mining, I'm allowing myself to talk about Bitcoin and not Ethereum. I think there was like a bet between Roger Ver and what's his name? I don't remember from the top of my head. I'm blanking on his name. Whether he can get a transaction mined within like 24 hours if he pays a dollar, and it wasn't about to. And then, you know, he asked his friend, like could you intrude, like add this transaction to your block? Because he knows the guy who runs the pool. So the idea is that the pools and really the set put up and the topology allows people in the know to do stuff that isn't open for everyone. And then Ivan comes in something like saying, well, what about if anybody could propose, oh, here's here's the block. I propose a block to the pools. Here's what, and I'll offer you X, right? I'll pay you one ETH. And I come in and say, oh, I'll pay you 1.1. And somebody else would. And so pools would choose the thing that pays them the most, but anybody can participate. Anybody could do that. And this goes into MEV, minor extractable value. Although somebody called it recently market extractable value, which I kind of like, and there is some, like, it's potentially a good name, but better basically, like, yeah, so maximal is wrong. Like people try to call it like Mac, but market, okay, putting it aside for a second because there's this, a nuance there, but basically, the idea of relay networks coming in and allow people, you can't just, if you will want, well, you know all the miners and all the pools, so you maybe can pull it up. But the rando, you know, Anon from Twitter can't send, propose a block to F2Pool and Ethermine and whoever because he doesn't know them and he's not directly connected to them. And they're not going to be willing to just like get connected with everybody because they can DDoS them. So we have like a problem that only those in the know can do some things and others can't. And relay networks, and specifically mining DAO or BlockDAO or FlashBot, is saying like, oh, let's open access to them to everybody, right? Like we'll run that, and so they don't need to connect to like a billion untrusted people they don't know, and we kind of like act and find like a way for people to get connected to them. You agree, Ivan?
Yeah, exactly. And so if you let me sort of like summarize this, so like Will's concern was, it's like, oh, there's like all these like clever mechanisms being built, but like, what about the risk of centralization? And I think I agree with Uri that it's precisely the opposite. Sort of the more cleverness in the system, the less of a risk of centralization is there. And so if you take kind of like the simplest situation, which is just like pools competing with one another, there's a very clear trend for centralization, and there's forces for centralization. There's none for decentralization. So if you're the biggest pool, especially on Ethereum, that means like you have lower uncle rates because you would never uncle yourself. You have the best brand. You have the best DevOps. You have the best economies of scale. Most importantly, now you have a platform, and we'll touch on MEV. I guess we've already did. So MEV is like all these like arbitrage transactions that happen on Ethereum. It's kind of like free money being taken out of the system. Like a classic example would be a liquidation or a cross exchange arb. So if there's like a token listed for like $10 on Uniswap, $11 on SushiSwap, you'd be able to sort of bring the price in alignment, buy low, sell high, and essentially make money out of thin air. The problem with MEV is, or rather with extracting MEV, is that it's very heavy on labor. So you essentially need to like, you know, update to like V2, V3, all these new protocols, compete with like all the other arbitrageurs, do gas optimizations. And so back to the problem of centralization. The larger of a pool you are, the better of a platform you have to like hire these developers and monopolize MEV. And so that's kind of like the disaster scenario. Where, you know, like one pool, I don't know, say like Ethermine, because they've actually tried to build in-house MEV extraction capacity. If Ethermine has like the lowest uncle rates and the best MEV engineers and the most profits, and they put the profits back into like the best MEV engineers and so on, essentially like Ethereum is run by Ethermine now, and that's not great. And so the way to solve this is essentially mechanisms that cut across the stack. And so if you can unbundle, you know, like shares accounting through smart pool, if you can unbundle block propagation through BlocksRoute, that means now all of a sudden kind of smaller miners have a chance. All of a sudden they're on equal footing with Ethermine. And then kind of like the MEV relays like FlashBots or BlocksRoute or Mining DAO, they're sort of unbundling kind of the auction part of the MEV, where essentially kind of the way the MEV is auctioned off is there's like $1,000 of free money, right? It's like, be that like $1,000 liquidation or $1,000 like exchange opportunity. And so people bid in transaction fees, just like, oh, I'll pay $1 for this transaction that makes me $1,000. And then somebody else is like, well, I'll actually pay $2, $20, $30, $200, $300. And typically they would like go up to like $999 or something. And then kind of the MEV is dissipated into the system. Or rather it's just kind of like a block reward subsidy on top of the like typical 2 Ether block subsidy. But for that to happen, you need transparency in the system where kind of if Ethermine is like the very best at extraction, they might actually not favor people paying $999 for the 1,000. They would favor themselves taking it for $1. And so here, I think it's a good moment to dive into this other important part, which I think matters on Ethereum a lot more than it matters on Bitcoin. And there's actually a lot of conflict of interest between mining pools and miners. Again, on Bitcoin, it doesn't matter as much because, like, whatever, you mine the blocks, you know, the transactions are like sort of, they all pay the same fee, and then you take a little cut and that's it. On Ethereum, if you're a mining pool and you can hide MEV, that's actually very good for you because then you don't have to account for it with your users. And so kind of that's the example I gave where, let's say there's a $1,000 MEV opportunity. And then normally people would be bidding $1, $2, whatever, $999. And that $999 would be going to the miners. So in the end, it should go to like the GPU owners. And that's kind of like the state of the system if mining pools are just kind of obliviously doing what they're told, obliviously running gas. But that's not what they do. And it's already been proven that like at least a few of them, like definitely at least Ethermine, used to run the bots where they take this like $1,000 opportunity, pay $1 and like put themselves in front. And then the total block reward looks lower. And so then you kind of don't have to pay your users. You can just say, it's like, well, look, there's like, it's kind of been a lull, you know, the block reward is to Ether, you know, there's like some weird address that we don't know about that made a lot of money, but that doesn't really have anything to do with you. You just like go ahead and like get the block reward.
Or even just pay, you know, pay a lot of gas, but not to the point that it eats the entire thing, right? If mining pool takes 1% out of the entire thing, then and there's like $1,000 opportunity, it's worth for the pools to accept $20 to themselves rather than $999 for everybody, right? They'll keep $10 out of $1,000. So even if they don't put it with like the minimal fee, even if they put a lot of fee, they make the transaction look normal. It's somewhere in the middle. It's in the top or something like that. But even then, it's just like, if they can capture a bigger piece of that, then like they would.
Yep.
It makes sense for them.
Yeah, and by the way, now's a good time to sort of explain, I think, why mining DAO is different. What we decided to do is kind of at the time we were like starting to launch this, the end game was not clear. And what pools were getting away with is like taking up to like 10% or 20% of MEV for themselves, or sometimes even like 100%, like running these bots. But even if they got like the MEV for flash bots, they would like still kind of get a larger chunk. And so one note that I want to make is that like in a world where Bloxroute exists and flash bots exist, that world is still not necessarily the world where the GPU like at home miners get their fair payout. Because Bloxroute just puts all the other pools on an equal footing, and Flashbots kind of like maximizes the MEV, but pools could still sort of not run their own bots or like not a low or sort of take a higher cut. And so there needs to be like at least one pool that's guaranteed to pass through all the MEV. And so that kind of like breaks the cartel, and then kind of the GPU miners end up getting kind of like the full price that they deserve. And you know, that's kind of like the point that I was making earlier, that like the more there are pieces that cut across the stack, the kind of the more fair the ecosystem becomes. Kind of a random aside, but if you've guys read the like strategy letter by Joel Spolsky, or this post by Gurn that's like commoditizing the complement, essentially like commoditizing the complement is like a big concept in kind of Web2, where, for example, if you're like, you know, let's say you're like a hardware company like Intel, you're building processors, you want like the operating systems to be kind of abundant and interoperable, because then kind of like the key part of the ecosystem is the processor. Or conversely, if you're like running Windows, you want kind of all the hardware to be interoperable, and then kind of like the fulcrum of the system is Windows. And, you know, like obviously like back at the time, you know, Microsoft was incredibly successful in like commoditizing all the hardware suppliers. And here, I think kind of in crypto, it's a good thing that like nobody's been able to sort of monopolize the system, and it's all kind of been kept in balance by different participants.
Totally. And I want to kind of circle back to one thing you both have brought up, which is that there's a lot of different projects that are intersecting and kind of breaking up that relay network bandwidth so that everyone can kind of participate. And that itself is a decentralizing force within mining. I'd like to take a second, though, and kind of walk through a few projects out there and just kind of label them and how they fit into either the relay network stack or the MEV stack or something else. Maybe we can start with you, just kind of talking about how Bloxroot does that. I know there's a few other maybe competitors. Sure. You see them as, I mean, a lot of these things are open source, so it's weird to say that they're competitors or not. But if you could kind of walk our audience through what projects are out there that kind of do what you're talking about.
So what do we have out there? You have us, okay? We're really about like light speed, latency reducing, kind of like propagating transaction, propagating blocks, putting everybody like on equal footing. And we're a relay network, right? That's like that's fairly straightforward. Not to say that it's not extremely valuable, but I think it's easy to understand that if you see blocks faster, you identify opportunities faster, etc. So we're kind of like putting everybody on equal footing on that ground. And we already mentioned Flashbot, right? Flashbot is a relay network where, okay, everybody can offer MEV bundles, okay, like as Ivan mentioned, like, or maybe there's an opportunity there, right? You see somebody, I don't know, selling 1,000 ETH, so you want to front run it or back run it, or maybe like it creates an arbitrage compared to like balancer or something like that. So they act as a relay. And we're actually running MEV relays ourselves, like Flashbot MEV relay, the same code, so we just same but faster. They act in order to relay from the ecosystem, kind of like to all the miners and all the mining pools, like the bundles themselves. These are kind of like two pieces. Then you have something like, let's say, Eden, right? Eden came out and said, well, we're doing something like Flashbots, but we're going to do it with a token, right? So we're going to break it into, they had like, it compartmentalized it. They kind of like said, well, if you're an Eden holder, then first I don't remember if it's from you or to you, or maybe they have two options there, but basically your transactions go first and then like others, etc. And then after all of these come the bundles that you can like offer through that, and then regular transactions or something like that. And there was a lot of like pushback, obviously from the Flashbots crowd, but also from the entire ecosystem that this doesn't really make sense, right? Like the idea of Flashbot is to say, if I am looking for MEV value and Ivan is looking for MEV value and Ivan is better at this than me, then maybe I can capture $100. Then I could only offer $100, but maybe Ivan is better. So he can extract 120. So he can offer 101. Miners get more. He gets more. I lose, but he wins. So this kind of like pushes everybody to optimize, to extract the most value, making the best ones extract the most value, etc. Introducing a token, maybe pretty much just like, why don't you just do it with ETH or money? And basically, it kind of like, maybe Ivan, if you want to hop into that, but basically it skews the entire incentive. It doesn't really
exactly make sense. Exactly. Yeah. So I think kind of it's hard. I don't think it's possible to like make this incentive compatible, and I've like thought about this a bunch. So like, let's try and think about this. Right now, MEV is already the perfect auction. And so it used to be that like only front runs were the perfect auction because like you sort of compete on price to get in front, and then back runs where you want to get after some update, after the Oracle transaction or like some trade, were not a perfect auction because there was no way to communicate that preference. And so kind of it was not clear what to do. There was like a lot of spam going on. But with Flashbots, kind of MEV is already auctioned away kind of at the point where it's created. And so it's hard to replace kind of the perfect economic system with anything else. And so when you think about kind of like doing a token subsidy or like a token mechanism, then you kind of have to ask yourself, it's like, oh, well, how much are you paying and like for what? And so if there's a token holder, and let's say they've like held this token for a while, you know, maybe they've been like staking, or they just like have a large allocation to the token, And then the miner is paid to like prioritize the token holder. With like again, with the same token. The problem with that is if the miners paid a fixed amount, like, you know, let's say, you know, 10 tokens, then they essentially can make a new decision every block. So if the MEV is worth only 5 tokens and then the payout is 10 tokens, then the miner decides like, okay, I'll give it to the token holder, you know, be that like Eden token holder, like some other system. But then kind of the token ecosystem loses because they overpaid. They sort of like their fixed subsidy was less than the value that they got. And alternatively, if the value of MEV is like 20 tokens, the miner can, for one block, abstain from participating in the system and essentially say, well, you know, this MEV is like 20 tokens, which I don't know, let's say it's like $2,000, whatever. So whomever actually pays me $2,000 right now wins that MEV. And so you're only winning the auctions when you're overpaying. And if you'd be in a situation that's good for you, where, you know, the other side would be overpaying, the other side gets to switch. And so I think that's the problem with these token mechanisms. And then like the next kind of step you might decide to do, well, it's like, well, no. How about I pay as much of the token as, you know, the MEV opportunity is worth? But then you're like essentially back to like running Ether auctions, and that's kind of like the system that we have. And so
I think, I don't remember, it was MEV Intern and a few of the others who took Eden and created Greeden, right? They're kind of like, well, let me take an implementation that if it pays me the most, I would follow Eden. But if it's like, if there's a lot of MEV, I'll actually take whatever like flat what he's paying or something like that. So I'm not sure it actually makes a lot of sense. Yep. And maybe
is like basically the perfect solution, right? That's like exactly what I've outlined, that, you know, the way to exploit the system, it's that exactly. And so it's like not surprising.
But then it only makes sense. Then it's kind of like, well, what is the token worth? And then you always overpay with it. So it only works if the value of, you know, it's a token and people buy it and, you know, they pump it. Mm-hmm. So like, as long as it goes up, then it makes sense. But like if you're looking
pretty much longer, so. Yeah, so like I don't know if we want to like switch from like mining to like memetics essentially, but like there is like a valid subsidy there in that sort of, as long as like the retail is willing to buy this, you could like subsidize the system, and so it's this like weird kind of bundled conversion of like a retail faith into like MEV auction subsidy.
Yeah, Eden networks. Go ahead, Uri. I'll jump
in. No, go ahead.
Yeah, the Eden network ordeal going into September was pretty fascinating to see how you add this token mechanism, or you add a token to the mining auction, and you totally change the incentives involved, especially if on the backside the token has an allocation to a team, or if it, like there's the staking involved with it. Just for the audience, basically with that Eden network involved was like, instead of having the typical, hey, I'm going to pay a miner to include my transaction, you'd have to have some sort of token staking involved. And then there'd be the larger allocation of the token. And then you could kind of have your block, your transaction included the block a little bit differently. That's very high level.
There was a bit more than that, right? It's kind of like, well, if you produce the block according to the Eden rules, but who decides that? So it's like on the discretion of the Eden team. It's not really like a smart contract or something where, well, you produce it the right way and they give amounts based on whatever they want, basically. So it was kind of like, I don't know, I'm not sure if it's the great like example out there.
Exactly. And so I'll come back to the same point that kind of like the more pieces cut across the stack, the better it is. So like Uri said, like if it's the mining pool doing the switching, then, you know, then they can be punished. It's like, oh, after pool is mining like half the blocks with Eden, half the blocks not. So we'll, you know, punish them by giving them no rewards. But then if you give the ability to switch to individual miners, then it's impossible to detect or to sort of punish, because it would just seem like, you know, oh, that is when there's like a lot of MEV, kind of the, you know, like the MEV pool is getting all the hash rate. And when there's not a lot of MEV, there's like the token pool that's getting all the traction.
Totally. So I kind of want to pivot the conversation as we have about 15 minutes left here. And I want to talk about MEV in the popular imagination. We've seen that it's gone from this very small topic written back in 2017, 2018 with that Flash Boys 2.0 paper. You know, no, maybe a handful of people read it. Very influential, but not in mainstream media. Now, like I think last week I saw a Congress representative or someone tweeting about MEV. And I was like, what is going on? Like, how is this? Maybe it was a fake tweet. Go ahead.
I think it was a meme. I think he was about like the midterm election something.
Yeah,
which was also MEV, and then somebody like turned it into him. I don't think it reached the Congress yet, but I totally agree. This is like I don't know if it's the most interesting thing, but it's definitely in the top like three most interesting things like happening out there.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Now. Exactly. And if you let me backtrack, it actually got started like even earlier. So like the Flash Boys 2.0 paper was actually even like, from my perspective, it was actually kind of like late in the cycle. I think it got kickstarted. There was like some discussions on like Ethereum forums, like back in like 2014. And then there was this influential post about Bancor, which was like the very first Ethereum AMM. Before Uniswap, and so Emin Gensir and Phil Dayan basically like hypothesized that, you know, like it could be front run. They mentioned that like miners could definitely do it. And then, you know, as a fun throwback, my start in blockchain was actually kind of like doing that work with them and like proving that it can be done. And so kind of doing like the very first front run in like 2017. Even back then, it was, I very much remember like the estimation that was like 400,000 a year. And I was thinking, it's like, oh, should I take that as like the equivalent of like a big tech salary, or should I publish? And then like ended up publishing. But then I think it's been growing exponentially kind of like year by year. By like the Flash Boys paper 2 years later, it was, I think in the millions of dollars, at least a couple, maybe like 2 to 3 mil. And now it's in the hundreds of millions. For what it's worth, I actually think we've like, I think kind of like the meme is like overvalued at this point. It's very interesting. So like definitely agree with Uri that like if you kind of want to be a nerd snipe, it's one of the most fascinating and fun things you can do. But I think kind of the market is first off very competitive. So like we're very much at the stage where kind of like $1,000 MEV opportunity is like bid up to like $999. And then second, I think as kind of the ecosystem realizes that MEV is just like money you lose for no good reason, there's more and more solutions that obviate this. There's private transactions. So that's like, you know, blockstroutbackronomy.com or like Flashbus Protect. We have like a mining DAO service that's pretty similar. So first off, I think kind of there's multiple parts of the ecosystem fighting against it. And so I think kind of as a percentage of the crypto ecosystem, MEV will trend downward, not upward.
So I agree and disagree with you. First thing I want to say that the reason it's competitive, it's not even the fact that, you know, like out of the $1,000, 999 go to that, but you have like people like Edgar or whatnot, like a few really, really good people who are actually trying, like the idea is, can you extract more value and can you pay lower fees and you really optimize the crap out of it? To kind of like, so it's not really just the willingness to pay. Maybe you're willing to pay all of it, but somebody else is better at getting it cheaper. And so like he's extracting more than you would. You would never win that. That's one piece.
I would never win, but they would like also not win that much, right? So it's like, if there's like $1,000 MEV opportunity and somebody like guess optimized it, and so it's like instead of 999, it's like 950, they like only get the difference. They sort of don't get, you know, the full thousd.
I totally agree, but I do agree that the thing I do strongly agree with Ivan is that what happened is we moved from Uniswap V2 to Uniswap V3, which has a lot less, and you know that's just like half of it. But basically, people make transactions just like, well, I'm just going to accept the transaction no matter what. And you said like, no, I'm only accepting it if the slippage is so, like you're limiting that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff like happening there, which the ecosystem is smarter nowadays. And just like, because flashbots happen and MEV happens, everybody knows, okay, here are the ways to stop losing value that way. That is a good thing. And the thing that I disagree is about spiraling downwards, like the free easy opportunities are getting gone with kind of like with the ecosystem getting smarter. What I think is the super interesting thing happening, like in the domain of MEV, which is not there yet, but we're like heading that way, is like multi-chain MEV and centralized exchange and decentralized exchanges.
Exactly. And
I won't bother you.
Yeah.
Zoom it out a little bit as well, just for our audience.
For sure. So to zoom out, we've been kind of discussing kind of like the structure of it, like sort of where does the MEV really accrue? And so Uri mentioned Edgar, who's a well-known like MEV arbitrageur. And I actually don't worry about Edgar because I think we're like pretty close to the natural limit of like solidity gas optimizations. I worry a lot more about, you know, Lev from Symbolic or Evgeny from Wintermute trading because, and again, for to the kind of zoom out for the listeners, these are massive, or at least Wintermute is a massive, massive DeFi trading fund. They used to be maybe DeFi only. Now they do a lot of like centralized exchange arbitrage. And so I think kind of it's not so much MEV as kind of defined in the like Flash Boys paper. It's a lot more like, I guess I would say like traditional quant trading or like high frequency trading in the traditional financial system. So stuff like, you know, if there's like orders on Coinbase, like for example, you want one sort of high level MEV strategy that makes people a lot of money is they would have kind of a view on what a price of a given token is. So for example, they say that like, let's say, you know, MKR is worth like, you know, $11, like 23 cents. And it may be that like right now there's no arbitrage to be made because it's like roughly that price on Uniswap V3, roughly that price on Coinbase and so on. And kind of the spreads are very thin. But some of the things you can do is if you know just a little bit better, what is it that you want, you'd be able to like snipe liquidity on Uniswap or essentially be like a market maker with a view where kind of if you see somebody about to buy the token, you'd like sell it into them. And so it's this cross between kind of market making.
Let me make it maybe simpler to the audience. Basically, the idea is that if you operating like the simple MEV, and the good thing is kind of, well, if it's high on Uniswap and low on Balancer, well, you know, sell high, buy low, and kind of like until it kind of like balances everywhere out. But if you understand the price of MKR, it's the same thing, right? Like the price of that, whether that's on DeFi or centralized exchanges or the different ones, then you kind of like run your operation and you're like, okay, the internal price is $10. I think it's $10. Anywhere which is higher than that, I want to sell. Anywhere which is lower than that, that I want to buy. So this is not the regular MEV inside Ethereum, which is kind of like siloed, kind of like arbitrage that. But it's kind of like, well, maybe just crashed on, the price just crashed on Coinbase, right? And they operate at different like step sizes, right? Like DeFi operate like every block and layer two in every block, but shorter blocks. And centralized exchanges is real time. So you have like these very complex moving system, and the part of the MEV part is kind of still, if you see and you identify a change in the price in the centralized exchanges and you extract the value at the change, like I'm going to buy it, not because there is an arbitrage between Balancer and Uniswap, because there's a arbitrage between that and the real price out there if I have like a holistic like view of the world. So this is where it moves. I think in 10 years, everybody would look at MEV right now and say, like, well, this was simple. Now it's complex, right? Like we look at it now and versus what it was like 2 years ago. And you said like, oh, it was simple then. Now it's complex. And I think we're going to have the same thinking like as we go forward, as it moves to how can I operate on multiple chains, reduce my risk, capture value, and combine decentralized exchanges and centralized exchanges. So all this, I think, is happening. And it's kind of like the point where I disagree, or maybe me and Ivan actually do agree, but we have a different phrasing of it. I don't think it's getting smaller or going away. I think it moving into this larger domain of real finance. And this is kind of like a holistic. It's not just about internal to what's happening within the Ethereum. It's kind of like centralized exchanges, decentralized exchanges, different chains. Do you agree, Ivan?
So that's a very interesting question. Let me think. My claim was not that it's going down, right? My claim was it's going down as a percentage of the ecosystem. So it's like between holding Ether versus like holding kind of the MEV meme, you'd want to hold Ether because kind of like, or even more specifically, if you can sort of like, if you can hold a Uniswap token or you can hold like Edgar's MEV profits. Like I'd rather have like the Uniswap token for like the same kind of investment value, because like as time goes forward, Uniswap MEV will trend down as a percentage. And there's two trends there. One is like, sure, kind of like the volume like is probably going up, the percentage is going down. So maybe kind of like one times the other is like still means that MEV is growing. But the counter trend is kind of the more platforms you have, the more there is MEV. And so kind of if you have Uniswap, you know, the MEV is like a certain amount. If you have Uniswap and SushiSwap, it's definitely higher. If you have like five different exchanges, it's much higher. If you have five different chains, if there's like a lot of trading on Near, on Avalanche, and Polygon, that leads to a lot more MEV. And so I don't really know kind of what the formula is. It is sort of like a volume times percentage, but then also I guess like times, you know, the number of exchanges or something like that. And you need to kind of account for that too. But I think kind of like Coinbase existed like 5 years ago, right? It's like Bancor existed 3 years ago. So it's not like, you know, sort of like centralized to decentralized completely did not exist previously. And I think kind of it should be trending downwards, or at least I'd expect that.
Totally. So we have about 2 minutes left here. We can go over a second if you guys are game. But I want to do 30-second questions to kind of end our conversation. The first one to start off with is arbitrage MEV. Ivan, I'll start with you.
Definitely, yes. So I guess like all arbitrage MEV is MEV, not all MEV is arbitrage.
Yeah, Uri?
I think it's obvious that yes. I'm not really understanding the argument that it isn't, except it's a PR argument, not a real argument.
Oh, don't say that. They'd never do PR talk.
on crypto Twitter, never.
Never. You would never do that. Okay. MEV on proof of stake. What is your opinion on that in 30 seconds or less? Uri, I'll give it to you.
MEV happens regardless if it's proof of work or proof of stake. There is a really interesting like direction in having it part of the protocol, which like I think Ivan is kind of like part of leading the way with that, and Vitalik's post on it, and basically, can we have that as part of the thing? From one end, it doesn't have anything to do whether it's proof of work or proof of stake. It's kind of like the same, but practically speaking. Well, now we're going to have the merge, right? You have like the validator and et cetera. And it seems like this is the direction where things are going. It's definitely going to happen and continue happening there, maybe as part of the protocol.
Ivan, your take on it?
I mostly agree with Uri. I think kind of like as a first order approximation, it's roughly the same because kind of the consensus layer and the MEV transactional layer are separate. Kind of the second order approximation would be that I think kind of in proof of stake, there's more risks of centralization, because pools are, at least like historically, they like used to be kind of more neutral. I think kind of like staking is a higher barrier to entry. And like some people were concerned that like on Avalanche, you need to like run a validator and stake about $300,000 to have a full node. Although the counterpoint to that would be that like staking entities are more regulated. So that would be more like Coinbase, I don't know, Anchorage and so on, BitGo. And so maybe actually there is a version of the world where a lot of the MEV goes away because just like, you know, the vast majority of ETH staked is on Coinbase and Coinbase is like not willing to do that. Or rather, I shouldn't say MEV, I should say kind of like malicious MEV, like front running. But like, Uri?
I'm going to throw in another 20 seconds into that. My thinking was originally that if like you have a company which is worth $100 billion, they're not going to do MEV and participate in that because the legal consequences of that, of making another $100 million per year for doing that, it just doesn't worth it. But it seems from talking with people participating in it that MEV affects the reward and the competitiveness of their staking services. And their staking services are much bigger than $100 million per year.
So, I buy that. I buy that. That said, I think staking has been like typically a loss leader for exchanges. And so the idea is not so much that like people make crazy money on staking. The idea is they don't feel like they're losing their staking rewards because Coinbase is doing nothing with their money. And then they're parking their Ether on Coinbase. And then whenever they want to like trade a shitcoin, it's right there and ready. They have the money to trade it. So kind of just knowing that it's like a service that they add as a loss leader, not like a key feature, is kind of my argument.
Good point.
We'll let you guys argue the nuances of staking on another channel, but I don't want to piss off my miners, so we'll keep away from it. Last question for you guys. Is there MEV on Bitcoin? And if so, is it worth exploiting in some sort of way by setting up a protocol to capture it? Uri?
I don't think there's really MEV per se on Bitcoin. Maybe Ivan knows better than me. But if there is, it is very minute, nothing at this point. Like if Bitcoin would kind of like develop into something very different, then it could be. But at the current setup, it's just not a thing.
Yeah, I'm with Uri. Not that I know of. Not substantial. Definitely not.
Awesome. Okay. I guess this is actually technically the last question. What research are you guys working on this coming year, and what are you most excited about, Ivan?
I mean, there's like a bunch of high level directions that, you know, I'm down to share kind of further down the line. One piece I'm trying to publish is kind of like the authoritative guide to like NFT floor sweeps. And so I've done that for a few kind of NFT whales where they bought like millions of dollars of NFTs in the same block through mining DAO. To avoid getting front run or avoid getting sellers kind of like raising the price on that. But it was very high touch. I needed to sort of like help them, you know, learn about mining DAO, learn about signing transactions and so on. So it's not kind of high level, you know. Next year, I'm trying to get myself to just like write this up and publish in the next couple of weeks.
Totally.
So that's my answer.
Love it. Uri?
I think mine is less of a research angle and more of like a practical thing. Like the core of our business, sending fast, hearing fast, really being like the flash boys for DeFi, right? Like just like, you know, speed of light connection. That's becoming such a big thing. And you're seeing like all these really big actors coming into that were just to stay on top of like all the demand that we have and kind of like, okay, new services and how can we integrate with NFT marketplaces and whatnot, just like all the additional features and specifically private transaction, right? Like avoiding MEV and kind of like opening that to the mass market is something I'm very excited about. So that's kind of like putting me at like 110% capacity. So it's kind of like, that's the thing, which I think I'm kind of like overworking on right now.
Totally. I think you're incredibly correct there. And that's why I wanted to have you guys both on the show. And I want to thank you both for coming on our show to talk about the ins and outs of Relay Networks and MEV. I think this was educational, at least for me and for the audience, certainly. You can find both Ivan and Uri on Twitter. Ivan also has some amazing articles you can go look up, and then follow Uri for more information on Blockroot. Everyone is using them for MEV. So if you're interested in that discussion, go check out their Discord. Again, I want to thank you both. If you're watching the show, please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. It really helps other miners find conversations with experts like these two, and that is a good thing, in my opinion. For us at Compass, that's a wrap, and thanks for watching the show. Thanks, Ivan. Thanks, Uri.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you.